What's up and welcome to Sweathead with Mark Pollard. Today I have the head of strategy from BBDO Dublin, Paul Fisher here. We're going to talk about humor in advertising, humor in the industry. Are we too serious? Are we making stuff that's too serious? But first of all, Paul, not everybody pays super close attention to Dublin. I got a sister over there, so I look at it a little bit. There's been some turmoil recently. What's been going on? Little news update.
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for having us, Mark. We've been in the headlines, it turns out. I think we're very aware we're a small country and we don't get much global attention. And often when we do, we get attention for good things. You know, I think we're seen as a welcoming, progressive country. And a few years ago, we voted for same-sex marriage and, you know, got global headlines for that. And that was brilliant. In the last week, there was a riot in Dublin. And the riot was kind of anti-immigrant, far right. And it was a real shock to a lot of people. It kind of woke a lot of people up. And there's obviously a long kind of, I suppose, investigation into it as to why it happened, how we missed it, what does it mean? And also very conscious of what does it say to the world about what Ireland is today. We pride ourselves on being a really welcoming country. And, you know, it turns out we're not as welcoming as we maybe like to be.
Wasn't there also a stabbing?
In a way, that was the catalyst. So there was a horrendous incident outside of school. And rumors quickly after the incident suggested that it might be an immigrant who was responsible for it. The real picture is somewhat complex than that, but there are a bunch of people who are waiting for that catalyst, you know, just waiting for an excuse really to kick off, to set light to buses, to attack the police and that kind of thing. So the two things are related in one way, but, you know, I think the incident, the horrifying incident, was used more of an excuse than a reason.
Yeah, I wasn't sure of like the closeness of it all. And obviously around that, there's some public figures like Conor McGregor, who are, I'm not going to say stoking fires, but he has a strong point of view. And at the same time, he was like really celebrating the, I think, Brazilian immigrant who's a delivery driver for getting involved with getting the knife out of that person's hand. And so there's a lot of stuff going on. And how much of this do you think is being fueled by particular countries? For how long have they been doing it?
It's no different to what is happening elsewhere in the world, but there's a group of far right agitators and a bit of dark money as well, you know, kind of fueling a bit of antagonism. There's an Irish singer called Imelda May, and she has this kind of phrase that you don't get to be Irish and racist, because obviously there's so many Irish people around the world. I think there's about 800,000 Irish-born people currently living overseas. We're only 5 million people. We're a tiny country. And then there's around 90 million, you know, kind of Irish-identified people around the world. So Irish people are immigrants, you know, in lots of different countries. So therefore, Irish people don't get to be anti-immigrant. It's not allowed. But if you're, you know, a far-right troublemaker, Ireland would be a good scalp. You know, we're kind of in the EU where, you know, it'd be a good country to turn. And there's a bit of that going on. And then, you know, the likes of Conor McGregor, I mean, I think his reputation outside of Ireland would be very different to his reputation inside of Ireland. He's not a very well-liked person here for obvious reasons. So there's a bit of that. And, you know, I mean, as with any riots, you need a couple of hundred people to set light to a city. You don't need the majority. There's been a huge backlash to it, unsurprisingly. But like I said, it's been a bit of a wake-up call, I think. I think we maybe things aren't as rosy as we like to think they are.
Yeah, it's weird this year. I mean, it'd be interesting to see if anybody does like a roundup of all the stuff that's been happening in that sort of far right and maybe even far left space from 2023, because, you know, you got people dressing up with masks, marching in a lot of countries, a lot of young guys. And it's like, what is that? There's definitely a correlation from what I understand between some of that behavior and personality traits. I think there's a dark triad, especially with men, around being Machiavellian, low in agreeableness. And there's another, I've forgotten what the third part of that. And so some of this is hardwired into us and the politicians play into it. Yeah, it's a very, very strange time. And I'm sorry to hear that it's been affecting Dublin, which to me, I would have thought was relatively conservative because of its strong Catholic past. And, you know, some of my friends who are older than me dealt, like they came up when the clergy were around not doing nice things. And there's like been a sort of pushback on all of that and a correction. And then in 2008, when I was there and Ireland was struggling before it sort of, I think, went full EU and started to work out how to make imaginary, or not imaginary money, but make money. When I was there, was a lot of Polish immigrants were there and they all left because the opportunities disappeared. And I guess there's like this new phase of immigration happening. It is a tiny country and Dublin's a tiny city. It's beautiful and fun. How does this affect the mood? Sorry to be like joining really serious stuff with our lives in advertising, but like, how does this stuff affect the mood of the people that you're working with on a day to day?
You're right. Immigration is a reasonably new phenomenon in Ireland. It's fair to say I'm actually English. I'm not Irish. I've lived here for about 16 years and, you know, Ireland is a very white country, and that's changing over time, and certainly in Dublin. I think because you know, the likes of Google and Meta and LinkedIn have their European HQs in Dublin, Ireland's becoming a lot more multicultural and international. And I think generally speaking, people see that as a good thing because that follows the trajectory of Ireland becoming a lot more prosperous and kind of interesting as a place to live. The industry is maybe disproportionately international. So, you know, I work in an agency of maybe 60 people. A third is, you know, are people from overseas, you know, people from Brazil and different places. So it's particularly wounding, I think, to kind of Adland because suddenly our colleagues who are from both overseas and also who live in the city centre are now a bit afraid. There's a sense that maybe this country doesn't want me here, which is a new thing and a not very nice thing to be wrestling with. We're only, you know, a few on the doorstep of the UK and been watching over the fence a little bit as what's happening with Brexit, the rise of the far right there, and telling ourselves that, you know, that's over there and we're much better than that. And aren't we kind of insulated from it? And this has been a little bit of that wall breaking down a little bit. And I think everybody feels slightly less secure than they did maybe a week ago.
Yeah, it's crazy because there are very rich, very wealthy, invisible forces actively engineering a lot of this stuff. It's sad. For what it's worth, not to center me at all, but I have a mixed race family. And so when we visited Dublin over the years, we sort of see how people react. And sometimes there's innocent things that might feel a bit racist, or sometimes, you know, we've not really had like overt racism in Ireland. But for example, in New York, so my family's half Korean. When you're seeing a lot of news about Asian people being pushed in front of trains, obviously people are like, do I even leave the house today? You know, and it's just, it's stuff that like, I can't subjectively understand it. I can try to feel it. But when you're seeing videos of this time and time again, or someone getting punched in the head because they're from a different country, like a 60-year-old Asian woman walking down the street, it's going to occupy a lot of your mind, right? So like, you're a leader. How do you create space for people feeling like that while also knowing you're in an industry that's under pressure, timelines, margins, pitching, etc.? Like, what do you do about it practically day to day as a leader?
I think the first thing we need to do is be hyper aware of it. When this was unfolding on that evening, the kind of WhatsApp group lit up amongst the fellow leaders of the agency to say, we have to get something out just to our colleagues to say, you're not going to be feeling great about what's going on. And some of our colleagues will be feeling really vulnerable and isolated. And first of all, we're here, we're there with you, we're alongside you. We're acknowledging this thing's out there and how you might be feeling, and react in whatever way you need to react. You know, if you need to stay at home, if you need to talk, if you need to rant, if you need to vent, you know, we got that message out straight away. And certainly we noticed a lot of our other agencies in town put out posts and put out stuff on their social. It's almost a given in Adland that, you know, there's a certain, I suppose, type of politics, if you like, you know, there's a certain progressiveness in agencies, typically speaking. You know, on one hand, it almost goes without saying how we would respond to that. But it felt certainly in that moment that it needed to be said as well. We needed to say the obvious and tell our colleagues who, you know, from the countries that are in the crosshairs of this small minority of far right people that we're on your side, we're not on their side, we're with you. We're an industry that, you know, often is almost criticized for making these big kind of grand statements about the world. And I think some of that criticism is valid. I know we'll get into that versus humor and that kind of thing a little bit later. But it is a bit of a responsibility we have as, you know, people who have voices in the public domain. We have that privilege of putting things up on billboards and beaming our message into people's homes. And you know, we shouldn't take that privilege lightly. And it certainly puts a different spin on things when, you know, this nice, peaceful little country is suddenly a little bit less nice and peaceful for a little while. It sharpens our message, I think, and sharpens our job to do.
So we're going to talk about humor in advertising and probably humor in the advertising industry. You know, there's various pieces of research. A lot of people have researched emotions or emotionality in advertising. Specifically, I'll use some big words here and there around receptivity of advertising. So how we receive it. And humor is really powerful as a way to get people to pay attention and to respond and hopefully to sort of put a little bit of the brand in their memory, which is obviously what we're all trying to do. Have you seen many funny ideas since all of this stuff's popped off?
No, and it's interesting. We obviously all went through the pandemic and I think the industry read the mood a little bit and, you know, maybe dialed down the humor and dialed up the sentimentality. And I haven't seen any new work hits since this launched, but it would be interesting to see what would happen if a really lighthearted kind of funny campaign landed right now, because it doesn't feel like we're in the mood for that. Now, obviously campaigns are 6 months in the making, sometimes more. So that's going to happen. It is a strange time. Now, how representative of this kind of current moment is of the next 6 months, 12 months in Ireland remains to be seen. I think there's room for humor still. You know, Ireland is a kind of lighthearted nation and we don't want to be defined by what happened one evening. But yeah, it suggests that we've got bigger issues and more serious things to talk about at the same time. And we can't be blind to that.
it's amazing how sometimes these moments do define an entire generation. I mean, I don't know what year it was. I think it was not the 1990s, but the early 2000s. We had what was called by the media the Cronulla riots. Cronulla is a beach area, very white, very blonde, in south of Sydney. And there were these raging, ongoing battles between surfers, white, so basically white, typically blonde surfers. And I think Lebanese community, they led to these big riots. And all of a sudden, the Australian flag became a right to far right thing and a symbol. And a lot of the people who identified with that kind of thinking started to get tattoos. And then you'd see the tattoos at the Olympics, and the Olympian might not have been a far right person, but they happened to have a tattoo. And I was like, oh, that seems to mean something different now. Not like the Confederate flag. I'm not saying the Australian flag is like the Confederate flag, but that moment in time in the media, it was on, you know, for a few weeks, maybe a few months, it did shift a lot, I feel, in the culture.
Yeah, I mean, as an English person living in Ireland, I've always been slightly jealous of how patriotism works in Ireland. You know, Irish people celebrate their Irishness in a really positive way. I mean, obviously, St. Patrick's Day is this global celebration. You know, the Irish people manage to be patriotic without it being anti-something or anti-someone, whereas my countrymen maybe have a much more complicated relationship with their sense of nationalism. But the people who were setting light to buses and smashing shops up last week would call themselves patriots. That's the term that they give themselves. So that's going to be a battle. You know, Ireland is a very flag-waving country, and I think a really positive. If you want to be Irish and you're from a different country, you're Irish, you know, arms open. That is under threat. I think that's going to be a real challenge. We work with a national telco. Aer Lingus is obviously Ireland's national airline. These are big flag-waving brands that are very proudly Irish. You wouldn't recommend that they stop being that because of a handful of people, but at the same time, it carries a different weight now. It's a different set of challenges for people like us to kind of navigate around. You know, do you lean into that more, actually, because we need to make sure that we don't let that go and we don't let other people kind of redefine what the flag means? That's going to be an interesting challenge for the next little while for us all, I think.
That's a lot of responsibility. And that's when you start to realize that, like, that little creative brief someone's writing could affect years and years and years of how someone perceives, in this case, a flag or their sense of patriotism, their sense of being Irish. That's amazing. Well, for those of you who are in that situation right now, good luck. May you succeed. Let's chat about humor. So again, there's lots of people who've researched humor in advertising and also on social media. I think Jonah Berger, he wrote a book called Contagious, and a lot of his research looked at emotionality of social posts, trying to understand what people were sharing. And I think he's been researching this stuff for probably 12 to 15 years. Did a project with him at Big Spaceship, actually. And one of the things that they would do with companies is take 5,000 social posts and then hire a whole group of people to grade them based on, does it make you feel angry? Does it make you feel happy? Does it make you feel blah, 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 and try to understand what worked. Now, obviously, a lot of this research has affected politics. The politicians get their hands on it and they're like, oh, let's just make people angry because we get their attention. And then we can get them onto the streets. And so, unfortunately, there are negative side effects of a lot of the stuff that we do. One of the big pieces of research that came out was from Kantar. I believe it was around 2022. What they looked at is the Kantar Creative Effectiveness Award winners compared to their Link ad testing database, which if you work any time, at least in a large agency, you're probably going to interact with directly or indirectly through a client. And what they found is only 33% of the ads that they've researched at Kantar incorporate some form of humor, yet half of the Kantar Creative Effectiveness Award winners use it. And then they also talk about how there's been a steady decline, and there's a few graphs going around. They look at, for example, the recession and the pandemic and how it affects in the short term, but potentially even in the long term, the use of humor. I'm going to get to a question in a second. When I first moved here 12 years ago, I was at Saatchi & Saatchi in New York, and I was like, oh my God, everything's so serious all the time. And people took themselves super seriously, which I think most of us do in advertising. And I'd ask people like, what is this? What is this? And it was explained to me, well, September 11 happened. And you know, where that happened, where we were working, was literally a 10-minute walk away or so. And then, you know, 2008 happened. And so there are these things that have shifted the way that we all approach things. And then a lot of the younger strategists I work with right now, they're super interested in making positive change in the world. And I say this to them, I think that's great. But also, the more serious you take yourself as you're doing it, the less interesting you're going to be. Therefore, probably the less attention you're going to get and the less effect you're actually going to have. You've got to work out how to be a bit mischievous and creative with something that's serious to you. And I think a lot of people struggle with that because they're competing to see who knows the topic the best or who's the most serious about the topic. So that's the backdrop. What's your take on humor in advertising? Is there enough of it? Is there too much of it? Is it just this thing we've been saying to ourselves that there's not enough humor in advertising as everyone gets older and they're like bemoaning great things from the past?
I think me and literally everybody else in the industry has been thinking a lot about this. And it seems to be almost the dominant conversation that we're having at the moment. And it's an interesting one. And as you say, there's an awful lot in the world that we should be taking seriously and that kind of thing. I think specifically there's this kind of, I suppose, accusation of the industry that the public want humor and they want more humor and we refuse to give them. It's really poor face. We take ourselves too seriously. So what we churn out is really, really serious stuff. And if that's true, then we're out of kilter with public sentiment, which is, you know, as a strategist, that's us, you know, that's a damning kind of indictment of the job we're doing. And I'm a middle-aged man with kids, so I don't have much of a social life. So I watch a lot of telly. You know, I sit on the couch watching sport and watching box sets a lot. So I'm exposed to quite a lot of ads. And that's not my impression. You know, an ad break will be full of ads that, in my view, at least trying to make me laugh. You know, whether they succeed or not is a different question. So I actually dug into it a little bit. So looked at the Super Bowl ads from this year's crop, the Christmas ads in the UK, that Kantar data you referenced, I had a look at that as well. And generally speaking, somewhere between 60 and 80% of ads currently on air this year are trying to make us laugh. Again, how successfully or not is a different question. So certainly that argument that we're not trying to pitch for humor isn't borne out by that data. I then looked into history a little bit. So the Adage has a list of the top 100 ads of last century. So if the argument is true that we're less inclined towards humor now, then you should see a, you know, greater representation of humor in that list. And the opposite's true. So of that 100, around about 32% were humor-led and 68% weren't. Now, the 68% were very much lent towards product benefits, you know, the kind of try to make you feel a way rather than make you laugh. So, you know, it's still emotional-centric ads, but humor is much more the dominant form now than it was back then, which I found really interesting. But I think where there is a gap is the ads that win awards, particularly kind of creative awards, you know, kind of Cannes Lion particularly. So if we look at the Grand Prix winners from this year's Cannes, 27% are human-led and 73% aren't. And the ones that aren't tend to be very serious. Now, tend to be addressing really, really serious causes like gun violence and issues like that. And that's great. And that's the work we all admire. But if there is a deficit of humor, it feels to be in the stuff that picks up gongs rather than the stuff that we actually push out to the public.
So just to recap your methodology here, you spend a day or a morning or something looking at about 200 ads. And subjectively, you split them into two categories, which is makes you laugh or makes you think, which is really, to be frank or honest, is makes Paul Fisher laugh or makes Paul Fisher think. Why is that the categorization? Because something that makes you laugh could make you think. Why did you split it out like that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, and it is a kind of unscientific piece of science, it's fair to say as well. You know, this is me on a Sunday morning with the kids banging on the door on the other side. So I think you could poke holes in this research very easily. But I think the makes you laugh part of it, and these aren't mutually exclusive, of course, you know, but if predominantly the point of the ad is a punchline, it's a joke, it's meant to make you giggle, laugh, or whatever it may be. And then the other side is that it's meant to make you, you know, feel that that could solve a problem in my life or that could solve a problem in the world. You know, that's the distinction. Now, obviously, stuff that makes you think can also be funny or joyful or playful, and stuff that makes you laugh should have a point to it, you know, or else it's not. I mean, an example from Cannes, actually, the Apple RIP Leon ad, I would say that's a make you laugh thing. It's a joke at the center of it. But it's a joke that has a product feature at the very center of it as well. So, you know, it's really, really hard work and it lands the product point really well. But it does through a gag, through a really, really simple gag. So, you know, again, these things aren't mutually exclusive at all. But, and I wouldn't look too closely at the research, that's for certain. I think generally speaking, this suggestion that we don't try and make people laugh, I don't think the data bears that out. But there is a disconnect between the work that we think is award worthy and the work that we actually push out into the public domain, which would make me conclude that maybe awards don't fully represent what we do as an industry at the moment. And that maybe is a slightly bigger concern and something that we should be looking at.
Let's get that in a second. Why would you, head of strategy, BBDO, Dublin, Young Family, decide to spend a Sunday morning doing this?
I think we should be an evidence-based industry. You know, we should take ourselves seriously, actually. We have a duty to speak from a place of truth and evidence rather than just speak from a place of assumption. And, you know, the evidence, the anecdotal evidence, the stuff that I could see on my TV when I'm trying to relax on an evening didn't support this accusation. So just had that itch to scratch. I think, you know, I think it's something that planners would probably can recognize that. Show me the data.
The operating part of my question is why Sunday morning, Paul?
You know, we all have busy jobs. It was probably something I read on the Friday that just percolated in the back of my head. And, you know, you have that kind of 10 minutes kind of wondering of a Sunday morning, that turns into a quick Google on your phone, and then before long you slide off your laptop. But it was a fun investigation. Part of what I was doing on that Sunday morning was watching some really great ads from history. It was brilliant. And you know, there's a whole other kind of conversation we could have about what we used to do in the last century that we don't do now that maybe we should. And it was, I found it really interesting. I'm a bit of an ad nerd. You know, I love the industry I work in. I love what we do. So it was kind of a pleasurable bit of investigation. But I think if you lose that curiosity, you're kind of struggling, I think, in the industry. I think it's, you know, if you don't have those little questions bubbling in your head, then, you know, you maybe need to ask yourself why. I think that's why I'm in the job, certainly.
Smart person. Hey, pull your mind out of those timesheets for a second and take a look at the Sweathead website. We have 3 membership levels: Starter Mode, Flight Mode, and Beast Mode. They give you access to a variety of strategy masterclasses, conferences, accelerators, and online learning, some of which has been known to make people cry because they like it, they like it, they feel seen. Make the most of your mind this year or any year and visit www.sweathead.com today. Now back to the interview. Let's talk a little bit about the awards problem, because this thing comes up or every award season or every time CAN happens. I'm going to give you my position on awards. I think they are good and necessary for a few reasons. One is we work in a relatively like ambiguous industry. Awards can send a clear signal to your teams that we have high expectations. And the research I've read around talent or getting good at things or even education, looking at kids who grow up in poorer neighborhoods, clear and high expectations are really, really important. Being told when you're young that you're really good, that you've got to strive, even if you're in a really difficult situation, can lead to better outcomes. Okay. Anytime I talk social science research, it's going to get debunked. So I don't hold on to this too much like dogma, but clear and high expectations, I think, are really, really good. The second is it gives like a pattern to the year, a seasonality to the year, which I think is really useful if you're doing work that's pretty bouncy and chaotic, to have these seasons where you focus. 3, encourage people to try to be accountable for their work, even though so many award entries, including effectiveness and including APG award entries, are obviously post-rationalized, not to diminish the power of those awards because they're amazing and change careers and et cetera. So I think there's a few reasons for awards to be good. But then every year we see people talking about how awards are a waste of time. There's always a strategist who's like, I don't even value awards at all. And I'm like, I feel like you're missing part of how they're useful. What's your take on awards in general? And then let's chat about some of the challenges you see with them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably somewhere between those two positions. I think I absolutely see the value of awards. And I think it creates a set of standards, and a good set of awards, a good crop of award winners should point to the future. You know, like, I'm sure architectural awards don't give prizes to the best 3 bed semi-detached house. You know, they'll show here's what the future of architecture looks like, and we should be doing a bit of that, and it should be the pioneer and stuff, and the stuff that's breaking new ground should be the stuff that picks up awards. So they are massively important. I think, as you said, reputations are built on them. It keeps us pushing forward. It kind of opens our minds and our eyes of what should be. Awards themselves are great, and particularly effectiveness awards. I think, you know, that makes our business feel a lot more serious, and, you know, that marketing is an investment, it's advertising is an investment, not a cost, all of that good stuff. I think where my concern comes is that awards are very resource intensive, both in terms of hours and costs, and agencies are very lean at the moment. You know, we don't have a lot of resource to be thrown around. And I think if we're throwing resource at a version of awards that kind of don't represent what we do at all, and that's a very extreme way of putting it, but if we're putting time and energy into work that is award work but not real work, then that's time and energy that we're not putting on our real work. So, you know, in an ad break, we're pushing a funny ad out. Is that funny ad worse than it should be because of the work that we're spending on award fodder? Awards themselves are great, but awards, when we have that disconnect between work that wins awards and work that we actually do, you know, that's a concern for me, I think, because it's the opportunity cost of that. I think the best brains and the biggest piles of energy are spent on stuff not for people, but for jurors. And I think that's the bit that concerns me. Some years are better than others. And I think we're all in this kind of like COVID rebound kind of thing where we're trying to figure out what is this industry, what is good work and that kind of thing. So maybe it's a symptom of the times. Just if you look at the pure numbers, that disconnect just feels particularly wide at the moment. And that's where I start to kind of get a bit worried about it.
Okay, so there's the opportunity cost. And for those out there, I worked somewhere that I think was doing revenue. I'll get these numbers slightly wrong. I think they were doing annual revenue of about let's call it 15 million, whatever currency, and they had about $300,000 put aside for award entries. So when I was young, I was like, holy crap, that seems like a ton of money. You know, it can be a big line item, especially for the companies that are winning a lot of awards. And obviously, even companies like Droga5, they were always talked about in other agencies that I got around as being so award focused that I think some of the early people they brought in, I'm getting this incorrect, but there's a truth in it, potentially make the case study maybe from the start. Or I remember a lot of the creative leaders I was working with were kind of envious that they had, again, might not be correct, but people perceive Droga5 in New York especially as being really geared to generating case studies every single day and really built a big part of their business around it. So I just know the chief creative officers I knew were very envious of that.
And that 300K line item is presumably the entry cost and materials to kind of create that stuff, which is a problem in itself, but it's just the best and brightest thinkers who are looking at that thing and not this thing. You know, it's that kind of energy. Whereas wouldn't it be great if that, you know, the stuff that's winning awards is known by the general public as well as the juries?
I think the counterpoint to the opportunity cost is having good case studies, which also potentially get awards, helps you to attract better talent. Some companies who do this to attract better talent can also pay them a little bit less. It's like, yeah, you could earn, you know, 20, 50% more maybe in a, I'm talking at a very senior level in company X, but you're not going to get to do the kind of work that we do because these case studies and awards also get us in the right rooms with the kind of clients who want to do this kind of work. So I think there's a pretty strong counter argument to the opportunity cost.
Yeah, I think it's fair. And I think, you know, clients tend to be a little bit monkey see, monkey do when it comes to awards. You know, if they're with an agency that has won a lion, let's say, for a different client, they want to do that kind of work as well. So, you know, awards generate ambition, not just within an agency, but also within a client list as well. So they're generally speaking a good thing. It's just, I think when there's a chasm between the work the industry does and the work that the industry celebrates, that's a concern. I think it's completely necessary as well. I think, you know, closing that chasm is good for the awards ceremonies as much as it is for the agencies. I think those two things should be two sides of the same coin. When you're with the kind of understanding that the stuff that win awards should be the, not necessarily the mean kind of stuff, it's more the stuff that's on the periphery and that kind of thing. But when those two things are kind of disconnected, I think that's when we have a problem.
I remember when I moved to the US, I was working with General Mills and was at their kind of marketing kickoff meeting, which had hundreds and hundreds of people in this theater in Minneapolis. And Nature Valley, one of their brands, had done some what they thought was pretty innovative work. To me, it was cool. There was more of a concept with the work rather than just like a straight up TV ad, which 12 years ago in the US, I don't know why it was sort of seen so innovative. That's not to take away from it. The number of times that that piece of work was referred to that year, like we need to do something like that. And, you know, it's like we need to do something like a Girl, or we need to do something like Subservient Chicken. It can be annoying, but also it helps because otherwise you're like, how do we get people to do better work? It's like, well, one of their peers has to have done better work and then we can use it to try to do better work. So I've seen that as well. If we were to close the chasm between today's award shows and what they reflect and then what agencies actually do, what does that even look like?
There's probably two very distinct sides to that. I think there's an artist, for instance, that can have a comedy category next year, which you could look at it as a step in the right direction that guarantees that that humor muscle is going to be strengthened amongst the juries. But the other way of looking at it is that it almost puts comedy as a humor as a kind of a silo or a niche within the industry. But there's moves that the awards, the people who run the awards can help do that. And that may be an example of it. At the same time, we should really be determined to raise the bar in terms of our business as usual. You know, the stuff that we churn out, rather than think, well, there's day-to-day work and then the stuff you'd put in awards. You know, how do we make our day-to-day work more awards worthy? So raising the bar in terms of what we push out on a day-to-day basis, but also creating conditions amongst, you know, in jury rooms that we're looking to penalize the work that we know is kind of bogus and is made for a jury room and, you know, celebrate the work that's been out there in the public domain and that real people have really responded to. I think the chasm is going to be closed by both sides getting towards the middle, not by the can changing its policies. You know, I think we need to up our game. I said at the start that I see it as a real privilege that we get to put our ideas onto billboards and onto TV screens and stuff. And I think sometimes we kind of take advantage of that privilege and we allow kind of substandard work to get out on a routine basis at times. And I think that's the other part of it. You know, I think that chasm exists much because of that as anything else.
Can you think of examples of brands, maybe in Ireland or the UK or internationally known, that you think they just do a really good job, very consistent, but might not be winning spectacular awards? like for me, what comes to mind in the US, and I don't know if these brands win awards, is like Progressive Insurance. They got these characters, Flo, they always turn up doing interesting stuff. State Farm, they have this character, Jake. There's always a little bit of comedy, but I think they're probably, and I've not seen numbers, but I would suggest, I'd imagine that they're quite effective, very disciplined. I think Doritos, Mountain Dew, there's a whole bunch of brands that turn up, at least in the Super Bowl, with very good discipline around their distinctive brand assets, a little bit of humor potentially, but and they're on television all the time reaching a lot of people, but I don't know if they're winning a ton of awards. I've not looked into it. Any examples from your side of the pond?
Not so much from Ireland, although there's plenty of examples in Ireland, but one example that really jumped to mind when you asked the question, McVitie's. So McVitie's is a kind of a cookie brand, a biscuit brand in the UK. And they had a campaign, a long run campaign, I think it ran for maybe 5 or 6 years. I think Grey London were responsible for it. And the campaign line was sweet with an extra E, sweet. And the premise was really simple, that McVitie's have a more indulgent cookie than their rivals. And they equated the feeling of eating a McVitie's biscuit with a fluffy kitten. So the premise is that, you know, a packet's opened and instead of a biscuit, a kitten comes out and people interact with the kitten. And it's one of those examples where the premise is really simple, but you just stay with the premise. And you stay with the premise until it gets weird and uncomfortable and surreal. And they did it for years. And it was so single-minded and simple and funny and warm and true to the product and everything. And I certainly can't remember seeing that picking up any major awards. You know, you could see how the public respond really well to it. It ran for so long that it must have researched really well. And it was really simple. It didn't try to be too tricksy. It was just, you know, it stuck to the bit, which I really admired.
Okay. And then can you think of a campaign? You can imply it or name it if you want to. Can you think of a campaign that's won a lot of awards that you don't think is like something that we should be awarding?
There's a bunch of brands in Ireland, particularly at the moment, who are doing very well in terms of effectiveness awards because they are really shouty. You know, the billboard looks like the TV and it's all, you know, simple, shouty, you know, hard-nosed commercial message. And I've no doubt that it cuts through. I've no doubt that sort of thing, you know, if you research it, people can remember the 3 or 4 word headline and the title and the things and the big, bright, garish colors. So for that brand in the immediate term, it'll work. My concern with that kind of work is that I think it diminishes the industry. I think, you know, the more aggressive a billboard is, or the more shouty a 30-second TV ad is, the more people are going to hate what we do and hate our industry and want to find as many ways as possible to kind of avoid what we do. Whereas if our work is, you know, a little bit entertaining or a little bit funny or a little bit thought-provoking, then people might not hate us quite as much as they hate us. I think particularly as we move into kind of areas where we do less broadcast and more activation and events and sponsorship and that kind of thing, you know, we need to earn the right to be there, first of all. And I think the stuff that gets eyeballs and grabs attention isn't always the stuff that is welcomed in people's lives as well. So there's a balance to strike there, I think.
There's a campaign doing the rounds from a brand that often gets a little bit of pushback from the industry, which is Oatly. I don't know if you've seen these things, okay? For those of you who have not seen them, there are these, I guess, billboards or outdoor paintings in English that I believe have happened in France. And then an object, could be a van or a box, I've just seen those two, get moved in front of the poster, very large poster, but in a way where the box or the van has some of the same words that are actually on the poster. And then the way that it's shot, the angle, the van and the words on the van blend in with the thing behind it. And people are like, that's in France. Why is it in English? And at the same time, everybody in this industry is seeing it. And I don't think many of us know what Oatly's doing with that stuff anyway. I mean, maybe they're launching a whole thing next year in English-speaking markets, and then they're going to use the footage for this, and they're just teasing all of us with it to get some outrage. But that's an example of a brand that often gets a little bit of pushback, and then an execution that people are questioning. Do you have a point of view on that one in particular?
I've seen that, and I've certainly seen the kind of discussion around it. It reminds me a lot of that, you know, those kind of CGI ads that are doing the rounds as well, you know, where there's a landmark in a city, and there's one for North Face at the moment where it's Big Ben wearing a North Face jacket, and it's that kind of shaky footage. And it feels like work that's made for the industry and not for the public. Now, whether it is, and as you say, whether there's a kind of chapter two for Oatly that makes sense of it all, you know, it feels like that's material that's meant to warm up this industry, so when that eventually makes its way to a jury room, that the jury's seen it before and that picks up an award. And we should be working in service of the public. That's our job. And I don't see that Oatly work is doing that at the moment. As I said, maybe there's a next chapter to it. Like, stuff like that's nice and it's creatively diverting, but it's a bit self-indulgent at the same time.
The thing that came to mind when I saw it was, I don't know if you've ever done martial arts or learned self-defense, but when people start out, they'll learn a left jab comes in and here's what you do. You parry this way, you step here, you do this. And it just reminds me of like in the early days of martial arts, someone going, okay, try and hit me. But someone uses the right hand and they're like, no, use your left hand. Now move it down a little bit. Okay, now do it. And then they do their technique. Like you're moving a truck, like you're going to watch a van back up or a box get placed in a particular angle so that the person with the camera can see things align. I'm like, what? But people are talking about it and they're seeing it. And so on one hand, you have to sort of applaud what they're doing. And then I don't think any of us have enough information to be able to judge whether it's going to get used elsewhere or over the long term or in an English-speaking market. So it's just been interesting to see the hot takes on all of that.
I think that's fair. And also, it takes a little while to be revealed. And I don't think that's how the public respond to what we do. You know, that piece asks an awful lot of the public. And the payoff's not that great either. But, I don't like to criticize other people's work, so...
But in their defense, they've got our attention, and the videos that I've seen, maybe just shared within the industry, have reached millions of people.
Absolutely.
And the people in this industry would drink milk alternatives. So I don't know.
It's like, I mentioned the Apple RIP Leon example. I'm really drawn to kind of, examples where humor's used to just say something incredibly simple. And I think that is an example where it's a bit too nuanced. There's a bit too much going on and I'm still not entirely sure what I'm looking at, even though I've seen it a few times. So yeah.
Especially for other department leaders, the world's not going to get very funny. That's my trend report for the next decade. The world's not going to get very funny. It's going to get more and more serious. I think there's just so many powerful individuals and countries and technology that they're coming for our sense of humor. They're coming for our humanity. But let's assume that humor is still going to be effective. How could a department leader, strategy, creative, account lead, create a space, create an environment where the teams can feel that it's good to bring humor, even if the world is super serious on the outside?
It's something you mentioned earlier on, Mark. Just because the topic's serious doesn't mean to say the message needs to be serious. And there was a piece for the Channel 4 created. It's a trailer series of kind of climate focused programming that they had just very recently. And it was incredibly funny and weird and disturbing. I forget exactly what the line was, but it was related to climate skid marks. And it had a lot of politicians and powerful people with oil. Anyway, I won't describe it too much because this is a family podcast. But it was a serious topic presented with humor and therefore it was much easier to watch. You'd spend more time, it'd get more eyeballs, it was more enjoyable to watch. So I think humor can be an interesting tool almost because the topic's serious. I think humor can be a way of getting past people's instinct to avoid or to pull out. It's an agency kind of before my time, but we've worked a lot with in road safety. That's been a huge kind of focus of the agency over the last 10 years or so. And humor was used routinely in order to, when speaking to younger people about, issues around wearing a seatbelt and that kind of thing, humor was used in order to hook younger people in who would normally kind of reject anything that's too kind of consequent led, and using humor to kind of, I suppose, help people have an internal monologue of go, yeah, I do that. I don't be that person. And so I think humor can be an interesting way to work within a serious topic rather than just as a distraction,
For sure, for sure. Two quick examples, if you don't mind. Both by this guy, Jerry Graff, who was at Saatchi & Saatchi before I was there. He did this campaign at one of his agencies about climate change, in which it was delivered in a very serious way, but they renamed hurricanes and tornadoes or disasters that had names. They renamed them after climate change denying politicians. That's funny, but it was delivered in a really serious way. And another campaign he did was for a proposition, I think in California, about gay marriage. This must be 10 plus years ago. It's a 3-minute video. It's got at least one pretty well-known actor in it. And it starts with this sort of a couple of guys, they meet each other and it just tracks their relationship over 3 minutes, but it's probably a year or two where they're loving each other. They're having great times together. And then it gets darker and darker and darker. One of them walks in on the other masturbating in front of the screen and they're like, the relationship's falling apart. And obviously the twist is, why don't you let gay people be miserable like you too? Essentially, different words, right? But the delivery of it was relatively serious. It's the twist at the end that made it funny. It wasn't about landing punchlines, but I think incredible work.
I was briefly worked client side for a couple of years and wasn't very good at it. So one thing that was really clear to me, and it's a bit of a cliche thing, but we should be the best, the most enjoyable part of our clients. week or day. You know, like it's quite, being a client is hard work. Sometimes it's very serious, you know. So it's something I'd certainly kind of impress on my team that even if we're talking about a serious topic or quite a dry topic or a, you know, very kind of commercial topic, you know, present with energy and fun and humor. And, you know, even if the work itself isn't humorous, I think just this little kind of tick from pitching, the very first thing I'll do is make a little joke, usually at my own expense. Doing that just kind of, I think it's a little signal to the room that this guy doesn't take himself too seriously and I'm not going to be bored rigid for the next 20 minutes or so. So I think humor, even just as a tool in a meeting room or in a relationship, is really important, as well as, you know, even if the output isn't humor-led.
Totally. There are cultural dimensions to self-deprecation at the start of the meeting. One particular, if you're in a position of power and you self-deprecate, you're more attractive, you're more interesting. If you're not very good or you're not in a position of power and you self-deprecate, there's a chance that the room will agree with your self-deprecation. So these things change. You know, the US is not a lot of self-deprecation, not a lot of witty banter at the start of meetings. And I remember glitching when I first came over because I was like, isn't this the part where we make a few jokes? And the rooms were always like stone cold. I'm like, oh my God, who am I? What am I doing here? A lot of self-doubt. Really appreciate this chat, Paul. And I hope Ireland can recover from what's been happening in the past couple of weeks. Where can people find you on the internet? Where are you most active?
LinkedIn, probably.
Best wishes to you and your team indefinitely, but definitely in the next few years. We're going through strange times. I know the holding companies in general are trying to work out what to do with the creative agencies or advertising agencies because they're seeing growth in other parts of their business. And so we're all going through this directly or indirectly, but may you and your teams do amazing work and hopefully cause a little bit of laughter on those public streets over there.
Thanks so much, Mark. Appreciate your time.
Peace.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sweathead. If you enjoyed it, please share it with a friend, subscribe to our newsletter, find us on Instagram or LinkedIn at Sweathead. And if you're interested in finding out about our strategy, memberships, company training, or books, visit sweathead.com. Whoop, whoop.